Welcome to The Future is Sound, a partnership in hearing podcast where we explore hearing healthcare with various experts in the field. Our next few episodes are guest hosted by Krista Yusko, an amazing educational audiologist in Edmonton, Alberta. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, everyone. I'm your guest host, Krista Yusko, and we're joined today by educational audiologist Amber Dara. Welcome, Amber. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you and I have worked together for a while now. How many years has it been, actually?
I believe it's been 6 years been direct colleagues and then pretty much my entire career otherwise indirectly. Yeah.
That's a long time. So, well, in that time, obviously, I've gotten to know you a little bit and about your four boys, your UPIC farm, your goats, and a little bit about your cochlear implant journey. But before we dive into that, I would love it if you could just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. So as you said, my name is Amber Dara, and I am currently working as an educational audiologist. I have been an audiologist since 2004. I worked in a hospital setting, private clinic, and now in schools over the course of my career. And I am married with four boys. And when I was pregnant with my second child, I learned that I have Usher 2A syndrome. Until then, the etiology of my hearing loss was unknown, and it was thought to be congenital, but I wasn't diagnosed with hearing aids until I was 4 years old.
So you were diagnosed at age four and fit pretty soon after that.
Correct.
And then you did not know you had Usher until you had your first child.
Second child, yes.
Second child, okay. And so can you tell me a little bit about your journey in coming to your Usher diagnosis?
Sure. So as an audiologist, I went to a conference and attended a talk on genetic hearing losses. I was working in private practice at the time and had often written in reports how families could pursue genetic testing to further investigate the cause of their child's hearing loss. But I realized after that I had no idea what happened. I would just tell them where to go, and then I didn't know the process that they were going through. So I reached out to the local geneticist's office involved in that testing, and I was connected to her genetic counselor. She agreed to meet with me, and while discussing the process of what families would go through when referred to their clinic, she indicated that families would fill out a questionnaire, and then based on the answers, the child would be referred for either syndromic or non-syndromic testing. And this was an attempt to be more efficient and narrow down the testing so they weren't just testing for everything. And I asked what sorts of questions would suggest a syndromic hearing loss. And one example she gave was difficulty seeing in the dark. And I said, hey, I have trouble seeing in the dark. So she suggested that I talk to my family physician about a referral to the clinic for myself. So I was referred, underwent testing, and then was diagnosed with Usher 2A syndrome. I was then referred to an ophthalmology specialist to monitor my vision. With Usher syndrome, it can affect hearing, vision, and balance. And my balance is unaffected with Usher type 2. My hearing loss was most likely congenital from birth, but it was initially in the mild to moderate range when I was first diagnosed. I believe my vision loss started in my 20s, where I started noticing a little bit more difficulty seeing in the dark. And that's when I remember starting to notice that. I'm lucky, and to date, my day vision remains relatively unaffected. I do have early onset cataracts that are thought to be because of my Usher syndrome, but they are being monitored at this point.
I didn't know that part about how you got to the genetic piece. That's really interesting. So do you have any thoughts in general regarding Usher syndrome?
Yes. So I guess when I think about my Usher syndrome diagnosis, initially, I remember when I was younger that my mom would always think maybe she had done something wrong when she was pregnant with me and that maybe caused my hearing loss. And she passed away 5 years before I was diagnosed. But I wish she could have known that it was genetic. It wasn't her fault. She didn't do anything during pregnancy that caused it. And I was, at the time that I was diagnosed with my hearing loss, my parents were told to expect me to get about a grade 6 education. And I remember my mom making a huge deal out of my grade 6 report card because I had honors to my audiologist at the time. And now I understand being a parent, what a milestone that must have been for her that we passed together, that like, here I am, we made it past grade six and we're going to keep going. And now that I know that I have Usher syndrome, when I was first diagnosed, I really struggled with the word syndrome. I still haven't really figured out why. And perhaps it meant because that meant there are multiple things that are sort of quote unquote wrong with me. And, you know, I think I've come to terms with that now, that I have this syndrome and it just means there's multiple parts to me. And, you know, yeah, I've come around on that. I know shortly before she died, my mom had said that she felt like my hearing loss made me feel like I always had to prove myself, that I could do anything that anyone else could. And I don't know if I would want to change that part about myself. So I don't know even if I could change all this, if I would. It depends on the day, how I feel about that, I think, if you were to ask me. I know I am worried or a little bit nervous or scared, really, about what happens when the vision loss starts to occur and the loss of independence that could come with that. When I was first diagnosed, I did cry and grieve for a little bit about that diagnosis. But for now, I'm just sort of, when I cross that bridge, you know, I'll deal with that. And one other thing is that often I think about that if I was born now, my family likely would have found out about the hearing loss and Usher syndrome right away. And because what I was diagnosed with, even if they went for genetic testing at the time, they wouldn't have identified that gene yet. And I'm actually kind of grateful that no one knew until I was an adult, because many people with Usher syndrome do lose their vision much younger, their daytime vision, but I'm still doing well even in my mid-40s. So I kind of wonder if I had been told younger about the vision loss part, would I have not pursued the same interests or career or things like that, because I would have thought at some point I'm going to be losing my vision. Maybe I can't do that. And I'm glad that I didn't have that thought of not being able to do anything.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Gosh, yeah. Interesting about the grade six piece, because not only did you make it through grade six, but you have your audiology doctorate and you're one of the most brilliant people I know. And that piece about, you know, just that determination. You are also one of the most self-determined people I know. Like, it is just such a pleasure working with you. And oh, I'm going to get emotional. I just think you're awesome, Amber. And like, you've gone through so much and it's made you who you are. Like, oh my goodness.
Thank you so much. I really enjoy working with you and I feel the same way about you.
You're just such a strong person. And like, oh my gosh, your boys, you have, she's four boys, guys. And she's just an amazing mom and an amazing audiologist. And I learn from you like every day. You make me a better audiologist. So thank you for that. So with the hearing loss, your hearing, obviously you were diagnosed initially with mild, moderate loss, and it's obviously progressed to the point that last year you became a candidate for a cochlear implant.
Right.
So what were some of the deciding factors in pursuing the CI?
Sure. So yes, I was initially diagnosed with hearing loss in the mild to moderate range, but slowly over the years, it gradually declined. And I am lucky that when I was a child, I was seen every year for a hearing test and was able to monitor that. And year to year, the results showed that there was no significant change. But if you were to look over a few years span, then you could see that there was changes happening, or there were changes happening. And I know when I first got my hearing aids, my mom said that I loved them and I put them in right from day one and I never resisted wearing them. And from day one, they said that I had to put them in and I did every day. And I know she said that there was a moment where I said, like, stop, I hear the birds. And then she cried. And she told me, I always found it hard to believe, but she swore up and down it was true that my hearing loss was initially diagnosed because I was playing in a water trough with my siblings and my parents yelled to us to stop. And my siblings did stop and I didn't. And I was apparently usually quite obedient. So they knew then that something was wrong because I didn't stop. And initially, my doctor told my parents that I probably wasn't talking as much because I had an older sister, but my parents trusted their gut and pushed for a hearing test anyway, and then I was diagnosed. Sorry, that was digressing a bit. In my 20s and 30s, I started to experience more significant decline in my hearing. I had been seen for a cochlear implant assessment a couple of times prior to when I was actually approved, but was determined not to be a candidate at that time. And at that time, the assessment criteria looked at what your better ear was hearing like. So my better ear was hearing too well to be a candidate in my poor ear. And so the time that I was actually approved is kind of an embarrassing story. But what happened was that I get frequent migraine headaches, and I had been laying down in my bedroom just trying to have it quiet. And I thought, I need to spend some time with the kids. So I was laying on the couch in the living room with a magic bag on my head while my kids were playing. And I had my hearing aids out though because of the migraine, and I just set them on my stomach. And then after a while, the magic bag wasn't hot anymore. And I had also laid it on my stomach, forgetting about the hearing aids. And I asked my then 6-year-old if he could take the magic bag and warm it back up for me for 2 minutes in the microwave. And I passed it to him, and he ran it to the microwave, started it, and came back to play, and I asked him to go grab it for me. And he started screaming that the magic bag was on fire. So I jumped up, went to the microwave, and sure enough, there were flames. So I quickly threw the magic bag in cold water in the sink. And then I went back to grab my hearing aids. And then that's when I realized I only had one hearing aid. So I ran back to the kitchen, and sure enough, the magic bag hadn't started on fire, but my hearing aid had. So I had to text some of my audiology colleagues that had put my hearing aids and say, I fried my hearing aid in the microwave. It was so embarrassing because that's not something an audiologist is supposed to do. And then as part of getting new hearing aids to replace the fried one, I needed an updated hearing test. And that test showed I really wasn't hearing very much out of my poor ear, especially for speech understanding, and that my better ear had come down a little bit as well. So they re-referred me to be assessed for a cochlear implant, and that time I was approved.
I love that story. And a couple of things come to mind when I hear you tell those two bits was just the importance of serial audiograms. You said initially that difference wasn't noticed from year to year, but when you compared over the course of a few years, how you really, the audiologist was noticing a drop. So just how important those regular audiologic assessments are. And that's that story. I mean, you know, so many parents worry about, and I know kids worry about, what if my hearing aids get wet or broken, or, you know, things happen to them. And even as an audiologist, you can say, yeah, I put them in the microwave.
Yeah. So my cochlear implant journey probably would have started a lot later. So, you know, maybe it happened for a reason.
Right. I love that. That story is always makes me smile. So with your CI, we were working together when you became a candidate, and I was there when you went, not at your bedside, but, you know, we were in the same office as you went through the process. What in that process was probably like the most surprising or the most unexpected?
There's been, to be honest, a few things that have surprised me. So just sort of first as a disclaimer, even though I've worked in lots of areas in my career, I've never actually worked with cochlear implant assessments or activations or adjustments. I've worked with people who have cochlear implants and other capacities, primarily using a remote microphone in conjunction with their cochlear implant. For me, the surgery part was luckily very smooth. I didn't have any nausea or vertigo. My biggest challenge at the beginning was sleeping at night because I could only lay one way and it wasn't the way I usually sleep. So I would kind of wake up with pain in my neck, and then I'd have a hard time falling back asleep. And then I went back to work around 7 days, but I feel like around 10 days was when I was starting to feel like I could sleep comfortably again. And that's when, you know, I was working well. Probably those 3 days before, I was quite exhausted. And I know when I first got activated, I was really surprised that there was a lag between my cochlear implant ear and my hearing aid ear. So the cochlear implant, everything would just come in a little bit slower than the hearing aid ear. So it almost sounded like an echo. And I was pretty nervous about that because I thought, this isn't going to sound great long term if it stays like that. And I can't remember exactly how long it was until that changed, but I think it was longer than 6 months. And so I really had to be patient with that to get that where it sounded like one signal going in. And it does now. It just took a little while for that to happen. And then another thing that surprised me was that I knew with my cochlear implant that I would have a hard time probably finding helmets that would be comfortable for biking just because I have extra stuff on the outside of my head. I didn't anticipate that with where the internal part is behind my ear, that I actually had a hard time finding sunglasses that were comfortable because it would be painful for me behind my ear once I wore them for a little while. And so I wear contact lenses almost exclusively. So probably with normal glasses, I would have the same experience that I would need to wear the glasses for a couple hours before I would know if they're comfortable. And I know with my cataracts, it's very important that I need to wear my sunglasses very consistently to help reduce the likelihood of them growing. So it took a lot of experimenting for me to find sunglasses that would fit comfortably. And that's not something that I anticipated was going to be something I would need to do. One other thing was that after my surgery, the cartilage on my ear was really floppy compared to before surgery or compared to my other ear. So I've never had problems keeping my hearing aids in my ear. They would stay on no problem. But when I first had my cochlear implant, the processor would just always falling off and then it'd be dangling by the magnet on the back of my ear. And this is, I have no affiliation with this, but I ended up getting a cool product that is made by a company called Deaf Metal, and it's got a retention ring and a holster. And everybody just thinks it looks like an earring, but it actually keeps it so my processor never falls off at all. So that was another sort of learning curve for me that I didn't realize that would happen. I just thought my ear cartilage was my ear cartilage, and I didn't realize that part would change. So,
sorry to interrupt. No, is that ahead. Something that the audiologist or the surgeon, I suppose, told you could happen? I've actually never heard of that occurring.
No, and I think it's not so much that the cartilage changed, but just when they did the surgery behind the ear, it just kind of changed the angle of my ear. And so probably not so much that the cartilage itself changed, but just the angle of way everything's sitting behind there. It just made it so it doesn't just tuck in as easily, and it just hangs there. And then because it's just hanging there, it would just fall, you know, I'd be at work and it would just fall off multiple times while I was talking to people, and I wouldn't realize till I got to the car, and then it'd be hanging in my hair, and then I'd have to, because it was still on, so I was still hearing, and then I'd have to pop it back in my ear. And sometimes I did notice, but yeah, it was just something I hadn't anticipated.
Well, and it's interesting about the Deaf Metal retention piece is because I was familiar that you had that, but I didn't know it was for retention. I thought it was a cool, like, cochlear implant jewelry, you know, how kids bling up their hearing aids, and we encourage students to, you know, go big and proud. So I just thought it was that piece. I didn't actually realize that it had a function. So that's.
Yeah, so it has the function and it's pretty at the same time. It's
very cool.
Yeah. And then I guess the last thing I would say, in going back to the initial question about what surprised me, was just that, so when I had my surgery, there's sometimes you still will have some remaining hearing left, but for me, I ended up losing all my residual hearing. So when I don't have my cochlear implant on, I'm not hearing anything out of my left ear. And I was activated in February 2022. So I've had it 1.5 years now. So even though it's been 1.5 years, I still struggle with the sensation when I first put my cochlear implant on. And there's something about just going from completely deaf in that ear to hearing in such a short time frame is completely overwhelming every single time I have to put on my cochlear implant. And usually, you know, 3, 4, 5 minutes, it feels totally normal and doesn't bother me at all. But I actually still dread that sensation when I first put it on every day, even though it's been 1.5 years and I wear them, you know, wear it every day. It isn't painful, so it's a hard sensation to describe. And the closest analogy I can think of is when you're driving home and you're playing your radio and you make it louder, and then, you know, you keep kind of turning it up, and then you turn the car off, and the next day you go to get in the car and you're getting blasted by the music, and you're like, whoa, how did I listen to that? And you have to quickly turn it down. And it's kind of the same sensation, except that you can't turn it down because that's what you need. So you just kind of persevere with it. And then it, you know, after a few minutes, it sounds normal and like a good volume again. I think in my ideal world, I wish the cochlear implant over 5 minutes gradually turned on from a very soft level to the level that I needed at. But I get the reason it doesn't, because probably there's some situations you need to put it on in here immediately. But yeah, that would be my wish and something that I didn't anticipate happening, but then also makes me, I think, a little more sympathetic when somebody is having a hard time getting used to their cochlear implant, because that initial feeling does feel loud and overwhelming.
ACI manufacturers, if you're listening out there, if that could be an option, Amber would be very grateful.
Yes.
I know you've spoken to other people and audiologists with cochlear implants. Have they also mentioned that, or do you feel that's unique to your experience?
You know what? I haven't really asked anybody else if that's something that they, because right now most of the people that I talk to with cochlear implants are kids, but I haven't really asked that. That's a good question. I should ask if that's something that more people experience, to see if it's unique to me or a need that's out there greater than me.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting piece. Gosh, you have so many interesting insights. So do you have anything that's like been super memorable or a cool experience with since you've had your CI, like that, like a listening experience that you have felt is pretty awesome or memorable, or maybe not awesome, maybe the opposite?
I've had a couple. One that's less awesome, maybe I'll start with. So like most people, I struggled at the beginning with choosing which cochlear implant manufacturer to go with. And ultimately, I chose one that I felt like was going to have the capacity for more upgrades in the future, and that allowed two electrodes to respond at one time, because I felt like that would be more what typical hearing is like, that not just one hair cell responds at a time. And then I also wanted one that was directly compatible with Roger personal DM systems. So those are my kind of rationale for what the one that I chose. And when I was going through my cochlear implant process, we switched to the processing strategy where two electrodes could be firing at one time, because that was part of my reason for choosing that cochlear implant. But when that happened, I struggled with facial stimulation, especially in response to high frequency sound. So like if my kids banged a spoon on a bowl, or we have this gymnastics mat, if they jumped on it, it made my left eye twitch. To the point that I'd be like, okay, you're doing my face, but they kind of thought it was funny sometimes. So I was like, just stop. So I thought that I just needed to persevere and get used to it. So I didn't let my cochlear implant audiologist know for a while. And then, but at the same time, there was other sounds that I wanted louder and I wanted it turned up. So that's kind of contradictory, you know, to want some stuff not as loud and other stuff louder. Eventually, it wasn't getting any better, so I made a follow-up appointment, and we tried multiple things, like turning off some electrodes, turning it down, and the only thing that worked to stop the facial stimulation was going back to the processing strategy where one electrode fired at a time. And initially, that was hard for me, because that was one of my reasons for choosing this one, so it was hard for me to let go of that, but I am doing very well with the processing strategy that I have right now. So
your clinical audiologist, your CI audiologist, think that at some point you can try the dual channel stimulation again?
I don't think so. And to be honest, I don't think that I would want to switch, because once you get used to one processing strategy, that's what your brain gets used to. And it's sort of like being reactivated all over again to switch processing strategies. It takes quite a bit to get used to. So I don't think we would go down that road again. And then a positive experience was once I was upstairs and I could hear the toilet running downstairs. And I live on an acreage and we have to haul in water. So if a toilet's running, that means we're going to run out of water, which is not fun. So normally I don't hear the toilet running until I just happen to be in the bathroom and see like, oh, the toilet's running. Crap, we're going to be out of water. So that was exciting to be, you know, I hear sound. I think the toilet might be running upstairs. And I was able to stop it before it became a problem. So
that's something very functional.
Yes.
Who would have thought that getting a CI would allow you to not have to haul in water?
Right. I mean, I still have to, but not if not someone flushes it and walks away and it's still running, not as often. Yeah.
So is there, I'm assuming there might be people listening to this podcast who have CIs or newly implanted or thinking about getting a cochlear implant, parents considering for children. Is there a valuable lesson or a piece of advice that you have that you'd like to share?
Sure. Initially, when my cochlear implant was activated, every sound I heard sounded to me like a hearing aid squealing or feeding back. So everything just sounded like that annoying sound that if you or your child wear hearing aids that nobody likes. And as an audiologist, I'd known to expect things not to sound great at the start. But most simulations were sort of, you know, that it would be a robotic voice or it would sound like the adults in Charlie Brown, that wah, wah, wah. But everything just sounded like a hearing aid squealing to me. I couldn't tell if it was speech. I couldn't tell if it was an environmental sound. It just was that squealing sound and I couldn't really differentiate. And I was part of Facebook, you know, you join Facebook groups and things like that to see what other people's experiences are. And then there's some people that post, you know, I can hear right away on the first day and I can understand speech the same day that I was activated. And I wanted to be a star too and be like, yes, I can hear speech right from the first day. So I was feeling discouraged at the beginning. And then also I was experiencing that lag between the hearing aid and the cochlear implant ear, which sounded like an echo. So initially when my cochlear implant was on, I was hearing worse with it on than I was with just my hearing aid on its own because I had this other sound that was kind of interfering with my hearing aid. And so that just made it, you know, harder to keep going. Initially, my plan had been I will, you know, wear both of them at work. And then when I get home from work, I'm going to take off my hearing aid and just wear my cochlear implant. But then my kids and my husband have struggled with me not being able to understand them. And I just felt like it wasn't working out because it wasn't very fair that I couldn't communicate with them at home either. So I did end up just wearing both of them at the same time. And that might have slowed down my adjustment to the cochlear implant than if I had just worn the cochlear implant on its own. But I did get used to both of them. And now they both sound as, you know, the sound is coming in as one signal. I actually have better speech understanding in my cochlear implant ear than my hearing aid ear now. So if, you know, I really need to, you know, it's been through testing, we've been able to confirm that I have better speech understanding, but I also notice it just day to day as well, that I can hear better with my cochlear implant ear than my hearing aid ear. So I think my biggest advice would be, I know everyone says this, but you really do just have to persevere and just keep wearing it every day, even when you don't want to. And then it does get better. And right now I use a cochlear implant and a hearing aid. Maybe one day I would have two cochlear implants, but right now I kind of love having the best of both worlds with having one cochlear implant and one hearing aid.
I love your story, Amber, your journey and how you can articulate, you know, you have that unique experience of being an audiologist with a cochlear implant. So you have the academic background with the personal experience and you can just articulate that so well and comment on things that, you know, maybe people aren't aware of or have assumptions about. So I love all your stories and really appreciate you spending some time here with us today. It was really exciting. And just want to say thank you. And I'm grateful and for joining us here at The Future is Sound. And I've really enjoyed our time together.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thanks. And listeners, we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to like and subscribe to stay up to date with upcoming podcasts. Or leave us a review and tell us what you'd like us to talk about in the future. Join our online community of Canadian pediatric audiologists on LinkedIn, or check out all of our latest tools and resources on our Partnership in Hearing website, both of these linked below in the description. We'll see you next time.